that's what we eat. That's all.
You still want us to hand him the part that was supposed to be able to do by hand?
Well, there is not much to do.
No. No, okay.
Yeah, so
this is good.
I have a few more things to say about wrong out there and how we represent things, but I want to start by jumping ahead a little bit because somebody alerted to me to the fact that the homework that we just talked about and that you have to have done by Tuesday discusses, for instance, things like continuing fractions and Newton's method, and in my head I thought I had already done that, but that turned out not to be the case. And so I just want to start with that, and then we'll go back. And so I need to tell you a little bit about Newton's method, and which is one of the sort of golden methods that people have been using in applied mathematics and for doing computational stuff. So Newton here is actually the Newton that you might have heard about. It turns out that this was also figured out by Raphson, who was a contemporary. And if you want to know a little bit more about it, you can go out, and I actually checked by now that there are two copies of this Pang's book out there, and he, I think, discusses some of this on page 63. So we're going to start by looking at this from the perspective of finding a root. So we know a function f of x, and what we're interested in is finding f here of x naught, maybe, where the function has a zero. If you look at the problem where you want to find all the zeros, then that may be a harder problem. Here, what we're really interested in is just finding one x naught here. So what we're going to assume here is that we have knowledge about the derivative of the function. We're going to talk about various different things, and particularly when we solve differential equations and we integrate functions. And even though you may think that you always should have knowledge about the derivative of a function, it turns out, and for practical application, quite often you may not actually have that information available. But here we assume that this is the case. And then I'm going to draw sort of a deceptively simple little drawing here. So I'm going to assume that f of x here is well behaved. And then I'm standing in this point. And where we want to get to is this point that I guess I called x0. Maybe we should call that xr. And I just said that we know the derivative everywhere. So I have a 6-year-old son, and we take him to Beavers. You may not know what Beavers is, but that's the first thing you do when you do Boy Scouts. And so what do? Well, you go and visit the police station. We did that Monday night after a tour up there. Now, the police officer took us down and saw the prison cells that they have there. They have the exact same cameras. I don't know why I'm telling you that. But well, you know, I didn't check the brand. But they were sort of moving. Anyway. sorry. Yeah. Now we got the poor guy. Looks like he's sad now. okay. Yeah, so what we want to do is that we want to locate this point. So we and then we have the so we start at an initial guess here. And okay, let me actually call this one for XR. So we start at a point here. Let's call it X1. And then I can calculate the derivative in X1. Then you can see all I would have to do now is that I can run down this line and see where this line will hit the x-axis. I'm going to call that x2. And then I'm going to, in x2, repeat that exercise. So then I get to x3 and so forth. The great virtue, which you may not know, is that this procedure here, it converges quadratically. And if you're not convinced about that, I can show you that over coffee, that this actually converges quadratically. That's very good. So if you can use this method for finding roots, it's actually a fairly good one. So all we need to do is if we start here in X1, then I need to figure out where X2 should be. So if I call this distance here delta X, then it's actually a fairly simple exercise, because I just need to say that 0 here, it should be equal to f of x, and then plus f, so let's call it f of x1 here, and then f prime of x1, and then times delta x. Because higher order derivatives for the moment, we, yes?
Necessarily that we have f prime everywhere. There's an alternative vision that we can actually use only f's everywhere to even estimate the derivative, like the second.
Yes, there.
It actually works well. For example, for our exercise, it works better than the Newton itself.
It's true. The there are variations of these methods, one thing you decide to want to get to is this method where you may not know it explicitly. Here, I'm going to assume that we do know it. If I do that, then you can see that all I need to determine here is delta x, and I'm going to write it so that it's just x n plus 1 here minus xn, or if you like, in this example that I'm looking at here, it's x2 minus x1. So here we see the delta x. It should actually simply be equal to minus f of x1 over f prime of x1. Okay. And if I say that delta x was what I wrote up here, it's x2 minus x1 here, then you can see that in the general case, I would simply get that xn plus 1 here, it's equal to xn, and then minus f of xn divided by the derivative there. So now, one thing I want to alert you to, let me just continue here.
So in the homework exercise, the question is, can we exploit that to do something interesting? And so can we use this to evaluate a function? And the answer is that we can do that in simple cases. So if I suppose that f of x here, it's simply x squared minus a, okay, then you know, probably if we work a bit on it, we can convince ourselves that the roots here should be plus or minus the square root of a. And so what we then can do is I can then actually view this here as a iterative way of determining the square root of a. Right? So all I need to do, if I want to get a function that calculates the square root of a number, is I can calculate the square root of a by iterating precisely the equation that I have over there. So it's xn plus 1 here, which is equal to xn, and then minus, I need to put the function, that's x squared minus a, and then over 2x, and then, oh, so this should be xn and xn, and if I divide through here, then you can actually see that this here is just 1 half, and then xn plus a over xn. So I think this is sort of, I kind of like this little recursive expression, because how would you ever know that this here is going to converge to, when I let n here go to infinity, I'm just going to get the square root of a. I want to point out one thing here. You can see that I'm cheating a little bit, because, well, everything here is fine, but the function that I start with is a nice parabolic function, right? It actually looks like what I drew here. And what that will mean is that you don't have to pick and choose any initial x1 that you're going to put in there will actually converge. Now, in a real life situation, you would probably, you would have to worry about what would happen if you were to look at a function that did something like this. And if you were looking at trying to locate a root that was here, but somehow you started out at this point, then obviously you would probably not go in the right direction and you would get stuck. So Newton's method here is very good, and it's probably one of the best techniques that you can use if you can get on the right slope, right? So you need to get within a certain distance of the root that you're looking at. Otherwise, you're just gonna be scooting off to somewhere else. The other thing is, if you don't know a lot about the function, it may find a root somewhere else that you may not be the one that you're looking for. Okay, so one can play these games, and so for the homework exercise, it's just, well, you might be amazed, maybe you won't be amazed, I don't know. But this converges very quickly. You can, if you look at the error, if you subtract off the known result, then you should be able to see how quickly the error will diminish, and it goes down very fast. while we're at it, I just want to mention that you can do exactly the same calculation in higher dimensions. So if we go into higher dimensions, this is actually I used this on many occasions, and what we have now is I have to have a vector of functions. So I would have f1 here of x1, x2 up to xn, and then I would have n of these functions. So x1, x2, up to xn. And these you would be looking, so we would call this f vector here of x vector. And it would be something of this form. So what you do now is that you expand each one of them. So I say that if I here of x and then plus some delta x here, I'm going to assume that it's just if I of x and then plus something here where I have a delta xj, but then I'm going to have to do now all the partial derivatives. So I get a sum here over from 1 to n. And then how if I varies with xj. Okay, so I can put this together. If I generalize this, then this would mean that f vector here of x vector, it's actually equal to f vector here of x vector, and then plus now the Jacobian. So I put two bars onto something that I call a matrix, and then dotted here with delta x. And so the equivalent of this equation here, I'm actually now going to have to solve a set of linear equations. So I get that j here, the Jacobian, and then dot this one is equal to minus this one here. So that can be solved here. So I get a set of linear equations. And so if you're ever stuck with solving, for instance, the beta ansatz equations, then you can make use of Newton's method, and it's. But you know, here it's no longer as transparent as to what we do for the one-dimensional case. Okay, so while we're at it, suppose we want to find a root, and I don't want to go through this long. Well, maybe it's not long, but suppose that I have not to know the derivative of the function. Can we then do other things? And the simplest possible thing that I can think of is called bisection. And I just want to tell you about that right now, because for the second homework, you're actually going to have to find a root using that method. And again, we're going to assume that we have a function that behaves nicely. So this here is our function, f of x, and then I have an interval here from a to b. So I'm no longer going to assume that I know the derivative of the function, but what I'm going to assume here is that we can bracket a zero. By this, I mean that I can determine the interval from A to B where at least one zero occurs. Okay, so we assume that we have a setting like this, and what I'm doing here, what I'm drawing here, is I just have a single zero, right? Now, if I look at this, you can see here that f of a here, if I multiply it by f of b, then that has to be less than zero. So by section here, the algorithm is very simple. I say that C here, it should be equal to A plus B over 2. Okay? So in other words, I take a number. Well, so let's actually, let's assume it does something like this. Okay, so I go to the midpoint here. So this would be our C. And then I let me see if I can do this right. So then I can look at, for instance, f of a here and multiply it by f of c. And if that is less than zero, then I set b equal to c. Else here, I said A equal to C. And then we repeat. Right? So what it'll do here is that at every step, it'll cut the interval around the root in half. And that's called bisection, and it's sort of related to other. So you could look at this as searching for the root, as you would do in a binary search here. And that also works very well, given the assumption here that I actually can figure out an interval where I have a root. Yeah. Yes, you were gonna.
Wouldn't it be wiser to store f a to a constant? Because the only thing that matters is the sign. But in that way, you evaluate f a like the times.
Sure. When I write an algorithm like this, it's what I would call sort of an abstract algorithm. It's not what sometimes is called pseudo-algorithm. I'm just there. Then you would implement this in Fortran, and yes, you may want to optimize that. So I think that's about the. As much as I'm going to be saying about root finding at all, but then if you read the homework, huh? Did anybody? If you try to do it without reading it, it might be. It's going to make it harder. So then there's another question here about. So the first. Problem is how you. The first problem is how you implement just the square root of x, and one of them was basically just doing this one. The other one is doing something that's called a continued fraction. And
So I wanna tell you a little bit about continuous fractions. So let me start by a rational number. So I start here with a rational number. And the rational number, that may be 13 over 11. And then maybe you're going to tell me, well, you know, I want the numerator to be smaller than the denominator, and so forth. But I'm going to write this here as 1 plus 2 over 11. And then I'm going to say this is equal to 1 plus 1 over 11 over 2. And then you're probably wondering, where is this going? But then I would do to this whatever I did here. So this I would write as 1 over 5 plus a half. And then we probably can't do better than this. So this here would be a continued fraction that ends. And it has to end because the number we started out with happened to be actually a rational number. So maybe instead of doing this, I should think about doing whatever I did here with an irrational number. What was the first irrational number that was discovered?
Pi
is a good guess.
Yes.
So my money would be on root 2, which has an interesting story. Because I think it was, well, so there are several anecdotes. It was one of the Pythagoreans that discovered that this number was irrational, and he was one of Pythagoras' disciples, and he believed in the version of string theory of that day. And the version of string theory of that day was that everything could be explained in terms of numbers. It was actually a very interesting theory that, you know, they were playing music and they discovered out the octaves and so forth. And the belief was that anything in the living world that had associated numbers with them, it's a great theory, right? And then, of course, it happened that somebody discovered that irrational numbers existed, and the rumor is that they dragged them out and drowned them. This was about, I should have this, I have this written somewhere in the notes here. I think this was around 440 BC, and never mind. If we don't know something, we just make it up. That's funny. Where am I getting to this? At that point, it was very. I think pi, you're right, it's a couple of hundred years later, even though there were probably estimates this from the Babylonians, they probably did something with this where they approximated it very badly, and the proof that pi is irrational, I don't know when that occurred. So why don't we try conservative 2 and then see what happens if we do that. And then we want to do what I did there, and oh, how can I do it? Well, I want to write the square root of 2, and then I write it as 1 plus square root of 2 minus 1. Huh. Okay, so I write this as 1 plus, and then maybe I should be doing square root of 2 minus 1 multiplied by square root of 2 plus 1, and then over square root of 2 plus 1. Automatically, this here is just 1 plus the 1 that I get up here, and then over square root of 2 plus 1. And this is equal to 1 plus 1 over 2 plus the square root of 2 minus 1. And then you notice something, and that's the fact that I have a square root of 2 minus 1 there, and then a square root of 2 minus 1 there. So I can immediately say that this is equal to 1 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2 plus square root of 2 minus 1. Right? And then it's not a stretch to see that actually square root of 2 is then just 1 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2. And if I go over and look at what happened here, you can see that this here, it never ends. So if you like, it's an infinite continuous fraction. Now, for the homework, you can do this for x. And, well, you can guess that now, how that's going to work out. It's going to be almost the same. If we want to evaluate a function like this, then there are a couple of problems with this. So let me just. If we look at this from a perspective of the homework where we want to write a routine that calculates the square root of x, then the first thing you might have tried would be a Fourier series. No, not a, oh, sorry, not a Fourier series, a Taylor series, right? And that would have given you a power series, and that you could probably determine a radius of convergence for that. But when I look at this one here, then there is, we don't really have a radius of convergence. It's not obvious here. Um,
when we should stop. But most importantly, the last thing is that usually the continued fraction oscillates. Around the desired result. If this here is the exact result, and I take this continued fraction and then sort of cut it off further and further down, then you're going to see a behavior sort of roughly similar to this. So it's not a simple monotonous convergence towards the desired result here. So now things get even worse because I don't have an eraser. What did I do with the eraser? There it is. We should perhaps figure out how should we evaluate something like this. And that sounds like a pretty benign question, but it actually has a there's an interesting point to this. So let me show you an example here. Suppose that I have an f of x here, and I have it written as b0 here, and then plus a1, and then over b1 plus a2 here, and then over b2 here. So we truncate here, right? There should probably have been a plus a3 over b3 plus and so forth, right? But we just stop here. Now what we and of course the b's here and the a's, they depend on x. Okay, so I can write this as b0 here, and then I'm gonna multiply through with b2. So this would be plus a1 b2, and then over b1 b2 plus a2, and then I'm gonna do this once again. So I'm going to say that this is equal to b0, b1, b2, and then plus a2, b0, plus a1, b2, and then I have this one, b1, b2, plus a2 downstairs. Now, you can see here that I have now actually a ratio of two polynomials here. So I have one in the numerator and one in the denominator. And I'm going to write this as actually a2 here over b2. Maybe we should put up x and x here. So the idea in a certain way, from a certain point of view, is that when I approximate a function by one of these continued fractions, instead of, suppose I had done it with a Taylor series, then in my opinion, I would call a Taylor series just a polynomial, right? A Taylor series is just a polynomial in x. The coefficients are determined as the derivative of the functions, that's right, but they're just constants. So a Taylor series, I would say, would give us a single polynomial. Here, when I did this, something else happened. Instead of arriving at a single polynomial, I actually get a ratio of two polynomials. So this here is sometimes called a rational approximant. And in particularly when you want to extrapolate, so at some point, whatever it is you do in physics, you have developed some theory and you have calculated points for x equal to 10, 1,000, but the desired result, it happens, or where you want to go, is either x equal to infinity or x equal to 0 outside of your range. And that means that you're going to have to do some kind of extrapolation. And this is a notoriously difficult question, and is much harder than interpolation, but the general belief here is that a rational approximant like this one will usually do better. And one reason for that is that if I just do a single polynomial, I cannot really get it to diverge, except, of course, at infinity. On the other hand, if I take just a simple ratio of two polynomials, it's very easy to faithfully represent divergences. So in some cases, these are very desirable. And I just want to point out here that when you go and look at how you would approximate a function here by a rational approximant, then one way of doing that is called a Peday approximant. And a Peday approximant is actually a special selection of these two polynomials where the coefficients have been tuned to match the power series of the function. So there's a relation here to Peday approximants. But we're not going to go in that direction for the moment. We're just going to look at a series like this one and see what can I do with this. And well, you can see if I could evaluate A2 and B2, then I could efficiently actually do that calculation. So it turns out that that these things here, AN, BN, they can be evaluated, let's call it recursively. So I can write out the way to do this. So one defines here A of minus 1 to be 1, B of minus 1 to be 0 here, and then A0 is equal to B0, and B0 is equal to 1, and then AJ here is equal to BJ, AJ minus 1, plus AJ, AJ minus 2. And big BJ here is equal to little BJ, big BJ minus 1, plus AJ, big BJ minus 2. Now, one could probably, you know, it's not difficult to see that this works out, but let me just convince you that it works, because I'm gonna show you that A2 and B2 here actually come out to be what we have here. So A2 here, well, it should be equal to B2 A1 plus A2 A0. isn't that right? And that would be equal to B2, and then I should look at A1. And A1 would be B1, and then A0 here plus A1, A minus 1. And then I need to add A2 here times B0. And this here you see is equal to B2. And then B1 and A0 is B0. And then plus A1 here. And then plus A2, B0. And lo and behold, that was actually what's written there. Right? Yes, it worked. And then B2 here, it should be equal to little b2 V1, and then A2 B0. Okay. And B0 here is just 1, so this is actually equal to B2 and then B1. And B1 here, that would be equal to B1. And then B0. And then plus A1, and then B minus 1. And this here gives us, this here gives us 0. And then I have plus the A2. Because B0 here is just equal to 1. In other words, here I get B2, B1 plus A2. So that's the same thing. The nice thing about evaluating this is that I can work upwards. So I can evaluate the continued fractions. Otherwise, usually, if you were to do it brute force, you would be starting maybe at an over bn, dividing that, and then working yourself down to the bottom of the continued fraction. Here, I start there, and then I can evaluate upwards. So I can evaluate an over big an over big an over big bn, and then I can just do the next iteration very simply, so I can immediately get big A n plus 1 over big B n plus 1. Yes?
I'm just lost in the computation. I can't actually figure out where we are heading to. Why are we heading to that? So I'm just see what you are writing on. I can't actually follow.
Well, the reason why I'm telling you this now is because you want to leave this for the homework. Mm-hmm. And the reason why, so you're asking why are we doing this now, is that it? Or the
why we are doing, I can't follow the computation because I don't, like from where you started, I'm just seeing the figures you are writing and going, I can't actually understand why we are writing.
The underlying reason why I'm telling you this and why you need to know this is because for whatever computation you're going to be doing, at some point you're going to be evaluating a function and you're going to need to implement it.
And this is one of the problems where everything will go wrong. So that's why I'm telling you about this and why you need to know this. Is that your question, or the is there something on the blackboard that you don't understand, or the You don't understand this? What we're doing here is that we want to evaluate this rational approximant, and what I'm telling you is that we cannot evaluate it all the way out to infinity, so we stop somewhere, right? In this case, I stopped there, and then I showed you that in doing that, I get to an equation here where I have A2 over B2, right? And in the general case here, suppose I hadn't stopped here, but I had stopped at AN over BN, then you would be asking the question, well, how would I actually evaluate AN and BN? And what I'm trying to convince you here is there's actually a very easy way of immediately getting AN and BN simply by evaluating them this way. So I can evaluate it this, I can evaluate them upwards starting by A minus 1 and B minus 1 and then work my way upwards. That's the point. And that has the added benefit that probably you may be, you're going to be using this and calculate the square root of x. And of course, we choose the square root of x because you know already the result that you should be getting. So maybe you figure out that when you did this, you get a result that was not at the desired precision. And you may decide to evaluate a n plus 1 over b n plus 1. And that you can get very, very simply just by applying this one once again. So it's very easy from this perspective to increase the precision. You had a question, Lee?
Special problem. Isn't that simpler than this? Because aren't all the A's and B's equal? Except the first B.
That might be true. I'm not going to tell you entirely the expressions for the square root of x are fairly simple. I'm telling you this because looking at things like this and building up approximations like this in the general case is actually very useful. Somebody else had a question here.
I can't tell you. So, and that's so maybe somebody that would do this for a living would be able to answer that question. My limited understanding is that that's actually not very well understood. And if the same thing with the behavior of Cadet approximants and really how, well, you know, the theory of Cadet approximants, you can say a lot more about this. But as I was trying to point out here, that the usual tools that you would be looking at, the radius of convergence is gone. And you're looking at something like this. The reason why I think it's interesting is that in quite a few cases, this is actually going to be very fun. And then secondly, it's developing continued fractions is actually something that I used extensively in many body calculations, which is sort of a nice way of looking at them. But the theory of how they converge is,
there will be a course by Carl Bender. He will talk extensively on those issues.
Okay, so ask him all about it. He talks a lot about Cadet approximations or okay, so I. I want to go back and I want to look at so this little intermission here. The fractions are fine.
I want to now go back and tie a few ends with this numerical precision that we looked at here. So so let's go so back to these numerical representations. So I wanna look at a little example here. And my little example here is sort of a toy model. And it's not going to be useful for anything else than I can write things out on the blackboard. So I'm going to assume that the numbers that I can represent, they look like zero, and then I just have three bits, B1, B2, and B3. And then this is all written in phase two here. And then I can multiply that by 2 to a power, k here. And I'm actually going to assume that k, and bi here, they're just zero. So this is very limited, right? I can only, so if I, what I can now do is I can list the numbers. So let's just list all numbers because they're not going to be very random. The first thing I can write is 0.000, and then multiply it by 2 to the power of 0. And I hope we might agree on the fact that this is just 0. Now, if I write 0.001 and again multiply it by 2 to the power 0, then when we go after the decimal point here, then this should be a half, a quarter, and 1 over 8. So this here would be 1 over 8, or I can faithfully represent 1 over 8. The next one up would be 0.010 and then 2 to the 0. And that should give me 2 over 8. And then I do 0.011 times 2 to the 0, and that should be 3 over 8. Right? Now, some of you might already be complaining that I didn't really put the decimal point where it should be there, and we'll get back to that in a few seconds. So here I have 4 over 8, and then 0.101, 2 to the 0. This here's 5 over 8. And then 0.1101 is 6 over 8. And then 0.111 times 2 to the 0. That gives us 7 over 8. Okay. Then I can repeat that little exercise, but with a power of 2 to the 1. And if I do that, then all these numbers, I just double them. So I get 0 here again, then I get 2 over 8, 4 over 8, 6 over 8, 8 over 8, and then 5 over 8, 12 over 8, and then the last one here is 14 over 8. The other thing I can do is that I can multiply them by 2 to the power minus 1. Again, I get 0, but then I get 1 over 16, 2 over 16, 3 over 16, 4 over 16, 5 over 16, 6 over 16, and 7 over 16. So what you can do here is that I can represent them on an axis, and then that sort of illustrate a few things. So if we start here in 0, I claim that I can represent that. But then the finest spacing that I can have here is actually 1 over 16. So if we do here, this here is supposed to be 1 over 16, 2 over 16. So I'm going to assume that this axis here is multiplied by 1 over 16, and then the numbers here are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 20, well, actually, 15, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, this would be 20, 25, and this would be 30. Now, if we look at then the numbers that I can represent here, then you can see that I can represent 0. I can represent 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, 6, 7, and 8. But 9, 16 doesn't occur anywhere here. So we skip over now to skipping every second of these numbers here. So I can do 10, I can do 12, I can do 14, and then I can do 16. But so 16 over 16 is 1, which we have right there. But So I have 1 and then 10 over 8, and then after that, then so you can see I go from 1, and then the next one up is actually 20, and then 24, and then 28. So as I go along the axis, you can see that the spacing between the numbers that I can represent faithfully, and by the way, these numbers are, of course, all going to turn out to be rational, then that spacing goes up. So they're not equally spaced. Okay, so that's an important thing. The other thing here is that this here is 1. And then we talked about the machine epsilon, and yesterday you I hope you played around on your computers a little bit with how this would work out. But the machine epsilon, that would be the smallest number that I would have to add to something, or have to add to 1, in order to get something that would be different from 1. Now, the first number that's different from 1, that's actually this one. So epsilon would probably have to be something like half this interval. So what would that be? It would be an eighth, which is of course, enormous. So the when you look at this, then you can see that there is something. I can represent some negative numbers here. Of course, I could have introduced a sign bit. So I could have done all the negative numbers here as well. And then I can represent some positive numbers. But once I start exceeding these, then I get what's called positive overflow. And this here would give us a positive underflow. So in my little model here, if I go over and I try to represent something that's less than 1 over 16, then the computer will have to make a decision what to do in that case, and often things might be rounded down to 0 or elsewhere. And that's what we call positive underflow. Maybe that's something that you desire, that things will be rounded down. The other thing here is that you can see that the numbers that I didn't that I drew here, they weren't all what we would call normalized. So the bit patterns I had, they were 0.000 and then 0.001, 0.010 and then 0.011, 0.100 and then 0.101, 0.110 and then finally 0.111. Now, if I go in and then I decide that I'm only going to be following my standard floating point notation, which we hear yesterday when you looked at it, you saw that on your computer, we say that the bit that goes here, it has to be 1, but let's just for illustration purposes say that we take that bit to be 0, and then it's the bit after the decimal point that should be non-zero, then we would say that only these are normalized. If you look at it, then that actually means that the points here where I had 1 over 16 and 2 over 16s and 3 over 16s, they're actually not normalized. So if I go ahead and impose some standard notation for my floating point numbers, then I shouldn't actually be able to represent those. And that has a curious effect, because you can see if I go in now and put my hand here and remove these points that I could represent, then I sort of get a hole at 0. And that is indeed the effect that one talks about, is that you can get a hole here at 0. So the reason why I'm telling you this is that you may think that things are all fine up here around 1 and you checked out your machine epsilon, but when you're trying to represent things down here at very very close to 0, you might run into this problem that there's actually something missing. A whole hole came in, just because we have to work with a normalized way of writing these floating point numbers. So if you try to do your calculations, you'll see that sometimes things will go wrong, and when you write the output, it's going to say something like NaN. Yes?
About the machine epsilon, why doesn't it go from 1 to the next?
Yes, you can, if you like it to go to the 1, I think the definition is that it's actually in that direction, but it doesn't matter, right? Because
it'll just, whatever value machine epsilon has, if you divide it by 2, is not going to change anything. The so it's sort of an what we're going to see in a few minutes, that the machine epsilon is going to determine roughly the round off errors and how you accumulate them, and the only thing you're really interested in is it going to be 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 16? I believe it's defined in this direction, but it. Oh, well, you mean why it doesn't go all the way up here? Because it's the smallest number I would have to add to get to that point. And so if you, I here sort of tried to indicate that it was probably half that interval, because, well, it depends on how you do round up or round down, right? Of course, if I add this whole distance, I'm going to get up to that point. But I would claim if I just try to add half that distance, then if it does the rounding correctly, I should still get that point.
The number, in its opinion, doesn't exist. This depends on how
stuff was implemented. And what you should know is that this is not defined in the Fortran standard. And it may be possible for you to control it by compiler options. So you look at some of these minus F, and I think I put in one. If you look at the first tutorial, there was some FPE, and that's floating point errors. Again, the golden rule here is that Fortran, it just wants to run everything as fast as it possibly can. And that would mean that any kind of checking for floating point handling or floating point error handling is usually default switched off. And if you use some of these toggles, then you're going to force the system to go in and have a specific standardized way of handling floating point errors. So a lot of the behavior that you want and maybe you don't want in terms of rounding and division by zero and these sort of things, you can control with compiler options. But roughly, when you're working on a system, you don't know unless you start poking around and see what happens. I had discussions with some of our system administrators. I said, well, you know, I wanted the IEEE behavior. So IEEE has a defined way of how errors should be handled and what if something gets rounded to zero and what if we divide by zero. But they just said, no, you know, that's your, I need to do this because it would slow down calculations too much if they switch that on. So the but most importantly, it's not it's usually not really defined anywhere, and so you would have to ask yourself these questions. If you played around with the tutorial yesterday, then you may have tried to look at, okay, so I was saying this NAN here, yeah, that was the point. Has anybody seen this coming out of their computer? Do you know what that is? What? Yeah, it means here not a number. So this here is not a number. And usually that is a value that is assigned once a calculation has happened that the system somehow couldn't handle. One occasion might be division by zero or something like this. So that's again one of the behavior that you have to think about. Should your program actually crash and fail if you divide by zero, would you allow it to continue? Yeah, what are you?
Can you assign this to something? For example, A equals none.
I don't know. Why don't you try?
So what we need to do is to declare a constant that would be anything. What we should do here is remember that the model that you looked at yesterday, it had an exponent here, And I told you that we always worked under the assumption that there was an implicit one, and then the bits over here. But how would we then represent zero? Zero here shouldn't have that bit set to one, right? And so the exponent here,
I told you that it couldn't be zero, and it could not have all the bits set. So these are reserved for denormalized numbers. And so if you want to actually assign NaN to a number, you could actually go in and just set the corresponding bits in the exponent that would be interpreted as the number being denormalized. In this case, I think you would just need to set all of them, but I'm just guessing. So the you can probably see now that we talked about some of these. We talked about how these floating point numbers are implemented, and if you now try to think ahead, how would you multiply two of these numbers together and get a result that was reliable, you can see that that would be a technical, very challenging problem, and how you want to do this efficiently, and that's why we have people that work on that. So I'm not, how you don't want to do floating point arithmetic is very very demanding. So I just wanted to mention, if you now go and look at what we called, so we talked about the 32 bits that was usually used for single precision. If we go and look at double precision, then things are slightly different. Usually, that means that you get 64 bits, and you get 52 bits for the mantissa here, and you get 11 bits for the exponent. And so the smallest number you can represent is something like 2 to the minus 1022, and that's 2.2, and then 10 to the minus 308. So if you remember, for the standard floating point here, this was an exponent of minus 38, so we go up to minus 308. If you look from the tutorial yesterday, then there was a statement where we used the function selected real kind, and we asked for an exponent that went up to 307, right? And so actually all you would need to do is to increase that exponent up to 309, and then the computer would have to either tell you that it couldn't do it, or it would have to go beyond double precision. The largest number here, it's actually 1.8 here, and then 10 to the 308, right? So if I look at machine epsilon here, then if I know here that this is 52 bits, then it's actually 2 to the minus 52. Just repeating the calculation we did yesterday for a simple floating point. And that's a number that you should remember, because that's 2.2 and then 10 to the minus 16. So if you're doing something in double precision, you would be expecting that errors would start to crop off around sort of 15, 14, 15, 16 digits after the decimal point. So this is, of course, way better than it is for the single floating point. So I wanna end here. I'll take a few more minutes, because what I want to show you now is that this epsilon here, it's basically gonna determine round off errors. So if I so let's start talking about round off errors and how they're gonna show up in your calculations. So I can write exactly, I can write that a number here, it's x and then 1 times b1, b2, and then out to infinity. So infinity is that way. And then I multiply this by 2 to the power m. You can see that any number I could actually write that way according to the discussions that we had. On the computer, we're gonna truncate it. So we chop it off. I'm gonna go in here, and then at some point, I'm simply gonna chop it off. And in the cases that we looked at here, if I just do that, I actually get a number that is, we might call x minus, because it would be to the left of the point I was trying to get at on the real axis. So maybe that would be 1, b1, b2 here, and then up to b23, and then times 2 to the power m. Okay. I can then say that for sure I could define now a number that would be on the other side of x, simply by going in here and then looking here at b1, b2, up to b23, and then add 2 to the minus 23 to it. So that would be on the right-hand side of the number I was trying to represent. So the scenario that we look at here is that I have x minus, then I have x plus, and then somewhere in between I have x. So if we now look at what happens when we try to so let's assume here that x is better represented by x minus, and then I want to look at the error that occurs in doing that. So I can look at now the distance between x and x minus, and this has to be less than or equal to a half, and then x plus here minus x minus. And that, of course, is equal to a half times 2 to the m minus 23. Right? And well, if we write this, then this is 2 to the m, and then minus 24. So when I look at x minus here, and then I divide it by x here, then this here is actually 2 to the m minus 24. And so let me write this here as q times 2 to the m here, where q here is between 1 and 2. Okay, so when I do this over here, then I have q and then times 2 to the m here. So this here is 1 over q and then 2 to the minus 24. And this here is less than or equal to 2 to the minus 24. And I could repeat this calculation with x plus, assuming that the best representation was by x plus. But the conclusion here, which is sort of important, is that the representation, let's call it, actually let me call it xc for whatever ends up being the representation that you use for the number on the computer here, it's equal to the true value of x and then 1 plus something that we often call delta. And you can see here that that delta in this case is less than or equal to 2 to the minus 24. And if you remember what we talked about for these 32-bit floating point numbers, then you can see that for practical purposes, you would say that delta here is precisely what we would call machine epsilon. Actually, you can see here that it, you can show here that it's less than or equal to machine epsilon. But so actually, this would be the equality that we use. So take a number, stick it on the computer, and what you're going to see here is that in doing so, you introduced an error, which is roughly of the order of the machine epsilon. So when we meet Monday, then we're going to talk about now how these errors here will unfortunately propagate through your calculations. And it's your job to figure out a way of controlling them so they don't totally contaminate what you're doing. And it's Friday, so let's get outside and enjoy the snow, right? Does anybody have any questions before we stop today? No, you just want to go get lunch? I also want to go get lunch. So let's go get lunch.
Which pressure depends on x? Only the a's, yeah?
Well, you know, it depends on what you're doing. It doesn't, I guess the